Greetings. You're listening to Horror Nerds at Church, a ridiculously queer podcast where we take a deep dive into a horror film and talk about how it connects to queerness, religion, and theology. My name is Pace Warfield May, and I am the sad lack of reference to Loomis in this film.
And hi, I'm Ben Monroe, and I seem to be getting a weird rash from this new silver shamrock skull Halloween mask that I got this year.
Yeah, gotta watch out for that. So listeners, we have now, I think you're our first guest that's been on, that's hit three. We've had a few that have hit two, but our first third time guest on the podcast, Ben Monroe.
Hi.
So welcome back. Yay.
Ben. Can you get a cookie or something? Or?
Ooh, yeah, that's a good, we will give you a, I don't know. I was going to try to think of some witty reference, but my brain's not working fast enough tonight. We'll give you a free coupon to buy another silver shamrock mask.
Excellent.
So that way you can have one for the whole family and sit in front of the screen for the I guess what? Two more days till Halloween. Halloween. So anyway, Ben Monroe has spent most of his life in Northern California, where he lives in the East Bay with his wife and two children. He is the author of In the Belly of the Beast and Other Tales of Cthulhu Wars, The Seething, which is coming out in 2023 from Bridges Gate Press, the graphic novel Planet Apocalypse, and short stories in several anthologies. You can find more information about him and his work at www.benmonroe.com, which will also be linked in the show notes. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. It's almost Halloween. It's my favorite time of year. And oh my gosh, it's been kind of a crazy week. I did a reading. I actually read from the first chapter of The Seething at the Hayward Public Library this past week with some other authors from one other Bridges Gate author and some other people who are just local members of the Horror Writers Association. And we had a really good time. I unfortunately brought home way too much Halloween candy, so I think I've reached my recommended daily allowance of York peppermint patties and peanut butter cups. But
love it,
yeah,
love it.
How about you? How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. It's been a stressful month for me. I had to travel back to the East Coast to take some stuff out of a storage unit, and so traveling is always stressful for me. But Halloween just kind of caught me off guard. That's already literally 2 days away. So, and it'll be today when this episode drops for all of you listeners. But
nice.
Speaking of spooky season, though, have you been watching any fun spooky movies or anything you want to share with the listeners aside from the one we're covering?
Aside from recovering, you know, I was actually just talking to a friend at work today. I just realized how many movies I'm behind on. I know people keep telling me that the new Flanagan series, The Midnight Club, is supposed to be really good. And yeah. I've been hearing great things about the new Del Toro Cabinet of Curiosities on Netflix. I did just see His House on Netflix, which I very highly recommend. Do you know anything about that?
No, I don't.
It's essentially, I mean, it's one of those kind of movies. And we'll probably get into this a little bit later when we talk about the new Halloween. I love horror movies that are scary, but are also about something else. And this is a movie that on the surface is a really good ghost story. But on a secondary level, there's a lot of interesting things to say about racism and immigrants and refugees and grief. It's about two Sudanese refugees who come to the UK, are set up in government housing, and then everything goes horror movie. But I very much recommend it. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was super smart, very scary. And so that's His House. It's on Netflix, and I'd recommend that one.
That's awesome. I've been also falling behind. I have watched Midnight Club, which I agree is a great show, and that's one of those that, similar to His House, as you're saying, has kind of is on the surface a scary show, but like also deals with death and trauma and grief and all these awesome things, and heavy things. I have not started Cabinet of Curiosities, but that is on my list. I've heard so much about that. But I've been trying to keep up with Interview with the Vampire series on AMC Plus, which is surprisingly really good. I've really been enjoying that. And the Chucky series, trying to keep up with that, which is also really fun. And I just started The Watcher on Netflix, which is kind of like true crime, but kind of also like horror. And it's just a really weird, interesting show so far. So see how that one goes.
I've heard people talking about The Watcher, and unfortunately, well, I should say everyone I've talked to who's watching it is just starting it. I haven't seen it yet. I should probably jump on that. I actually heard something really interesting about Interview today. Somebody talking, it was on one of my Facebook friends, talking about how even though it changes a lot from the book, it keeps the bones of the story. And it extrapolates in really interesting ways that are not so much like, let's just change stuff, but it's been 40 years since this book came out. Maybe it's time to reinterpret some things. Maybe take a look at what does a vampire mean, now as opposed to in the 1970s. And I think we talked about that a little bit on our Lost Boys show as far as what vampires mean. Oh, and that's actually the last awesome thing I saw. Was a few weeks ago when The Lost Boys were showing in cinemas. And so I got to go see that with my friend Buren, which was a blast. I haven't seen that on the big screen since probably 89 or 90 or something. And boy,
That's really
it's
awesome.
still one of my favorite movies ever. So everybody go back and listen to the Lost Boys episode.
Yeah, definitely. And wow, can't believe that was already a year ago that we had that episode come out, a little over a year ago. My,
Yes.
how far the podcast has come and grown since then.
Absolutely. Now you.
Well, we asked this question of all of our guests, and you've already answered it twice, so you don't have to answer it if again for a third time if you don't want to. But if you have one, please feel free. If you have a real life church horror story you'd like to share, again, it can be something supernatural, it can just be church people being shitty, it can be anything that's horrific that involves church.
I don't really have any. I was actually thinking about this because now I've been on the show a few times, so I kind of know the system. I was thinking about this on the way home tonight, and I don't have a specific story to tell, but I will say that, now that I'm back on the governing board at our church, and we just had our annual meeting, I've invented the church annual meeting drinking game, which is a lot of fun. Lutherans, we can probably pull this off, right? Which is basically when one of the you're having your annual meeting. And one of the patriarchs or elder statesmen of your church stands up and says the following: I've been hearing from a lot of people that that's when you take a drink. And
You'd be so wasted by the my goodness.
yeah. So,
But
that's it for me for that one.
well, fun, or not fun actually, but I think drinking game is a good way to cope with annual meetings, many of them.
It's
So
probably better than my my bacon communion sundae idea, probably.
bacon communion.
Yeah, I thought that would be a good way to fill the pews. Is give it one Sunday a month, you hand out bacon instead of wafers. I don't know. I mean,
Ooh,
people would like that, I'm sure.
Fun. So in case our listeners haven't caught on yet, and you missed it when you download the episode and saw the title on it, we are covering Halloween Ends, directed by David Gordon Green, came out earlier this month in 2022. And typically I ask when is the first time you've seen this film, but since this one's so new, I know we both saw it within the last 2 weeks. So more
Tuesday.
yeah, so like I'm more interested in like what was your first exposure to the Halloween franchise?
Oh my gosh. It's funny, thinking about that. I literally remember, I mean, 1978, right? It was 1978. It was 40 something years ago. I would have been about 8 years old, right? And that was the movie everyone at school was talking about. And there was one kid in my, fourth grade class, I think fourth grade, who claimed to have seen Halloween.
Oh, wow. Oh,
tell us all about it. Tell us all, you know, I mean, like there's kids in fourth grade who claim to have done everything. And so we would get together, like it instantly elevated his status because we could get together and we'd hang out with him at lunch. He would tell us about what happened. Oh, a guy gets murdered in the stomach and this other guy does this. And then, oh, the guy is scary and has a mask and it's bad. And yeah. And so that was probably my first exposure to the Halloween movies was just that, you know, we all knew it was supposed to be so scary. And some kid had seen it, and that was really neat. So, of course, it was kind of a forbidden fruit sort of thing.
Yeah.
I don't think I actually saw the movie until I was probably maybe a sophomore in high school. So I figured I'm like 14 or 15 or something. And I had I had an in at the local video store. I made friends with a senior who worked at the local video store. And that was when my delving into horror and horror classics really started because he would let me rent anything despite the restrictions on my account from that my parents had set up. So I watched all the Halloweens and everything. And yeah, so that's my story of how I first discovered the franchise, I guess, as it was happening, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. Ooh, I know I talked about this on season one. I didn't really get into the Halloween franchise until older. I kind of grew up on the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise, and so Friday the 13th and Halloween both kind of I knew about them and was obviously aware of them, but didn't really like watch them until probably the college year. So that's when I first really got into the franchise. And one of the remarkable things about the original film to me is that it still holds up in a way that many of the horror classics don't on scare level. Like certainly some aspects of it are a little bit cheesy or outdated now, but like it's still John Carpenter is just able to create such like a moody atmospheric film with little gore, but still like to keep that suspense sustained throughout the whole thing that it still to me is very effective 40 some years later. So.
Absolutely.
Well, I have a little bit of background about this one. This is, of course, the third part of the David Gordon Green Halloween trilogy, which was originally conceived as two films, but then expanded to three after the success of the first one, Halloween 2018. And David Gordon Green and Danny McBride, who were kind of the co-writers for all three, realized that they had enough material for three as well. It was originally scheduled to drop in 2020, but COVID delayed both Halloween Kills and this film to 2021 and 2022, respectively. It was announced in late 2021 after Halloween Kills that Halloween End would be set 4 years after Halloween 18 and would include references to the pandemic in that, although I don't really remember any direct references to the pandemic. But
I didn't notice any other.
Yeah, but I guess the pandemic must have happened in that world, and that may have added to the scare and fear going on in Haddonfield. So this is the end of David Gordon Green's Halloween trilogy, but of course not the end of the franchise. We've already heard rumors about a sequel to Halloween 3, which I know both you and I would love because we're big fans of Halloween 3, The Witch.
I love that movie.
So we'll see what happens, but yeah. So, quick going through the movie, Halloween 3 font for the credits, which I just love. So, giving a shout out to our beloved misfit of the Halloween franchise, and then we get Corey in the Halloween staircase with the demon child falling to his death. And also, this is legit just 1 year after Michael Myers was never found and after that massacre he went on. And people are just saying their kids roam around for Halloween. I just thought that was strange, but whatever. then we get the exploding pumpkins opening, which I thought was pretty cool.
I actually, I'm sorry, I can interrupt probably a couple of times while we talk, we go over the plot here, but I love that opening credit sequence with the shells of the pumpkins and new pumpkins bursting out and new pumpkins bursting out. To me, it was almost like a visual metaphor of the entire trilogy, what they were trying to say with the movies. We'll come back to that later, I'm sure.
And then we get the weird conceit of voiceover of Jamie Lee Curtis writing a memoir, and we also get a radio voiceover, which is interesting, like since 2018 started with the podcaster conceit, I think. But kind of general theme of moving on and surviving as a town put and Michael Myers still missing, and Laurie and her granddaughter Allison trying to get their life together. Sounds like Laurie's been in therapy. They bought a house, made some good improvements. Corey is getting bullied, and I love what you put here about who's bullying him.
Yeah, he's getting bullied by the marching band. I mean, it's not like the football guys, right? Or the, you know, I don't know, the I don't know, the I want to say greasers. I'm thinking of the guys in Christine, right? Like the Motorhead bullies. But it was just, it's the marching band. And I'm gonna point a finger at myself here, you know, as a band geek in high school and the founding member of the Berkeley High Dungeons and Dragons Club in 1985. You know, the marching band guys are like the guys like almost at lowest in the totem pole, just above the D&D guys. And so and so the idea that, oh my God, yeah, that this town, I mean, that's how much they really have kind of dumped on this poor kid Corey, is that if even the marching band feels they can bully this guy, you know, I kind of my heart kind of went out for him a lot in that movie. But
Same, same.
we'll come back to that
Yeah.
hopefully.
And while he's getting bullied, though, he runs into Laurie, who the kids also like stand up to. Like, I just find it so bizarre. Like, when I was a high schooler, to stand up to some, to like be that rude to a stranger, even if I knew who the stranger was, like, it just seems weird. So, like you said, kind of a sign of like what's going on in this town, I think. But Lori kind of sets up Corey and Allison by taking Allison's now working at a clinic, Haddonfield Memorial Hospital clinic of some sort. And I love that they kept that logo from Halloween too. And gets his hand stitched up by Allison and possibly a relationship to come there. And then we continue with Corey and Allison's basically starting a relationship, but then he gets beat up on the way home by the bullies and left for dead, where he gets dragged into the sewers by Michael Myers, who's been living there the past few 4 years, I guess. Dining on rats, I assume.
And the unhoused, apparently.
Yeah, apparently. And what's really interesting about that is it made me think of Halloween Resurrection, where there's that deleted scene that didn't make it into the final film, but where I think it was Tyra Banks' character, somebody goes under the house and finds out that Michael has been living in the sewers under the Myers house the
Right.
whole time. So,
Right.
yeah, Michael like stares into Corey's eyes. I think it's this is the part where the film lost me. It's just that like staring into the eyes part. It just felt so cheesy, but then that somehow transfers in some way some of Michael's evilness into Corey in some way, and so Corey goes at kind of seems to accidentally kill the unhoused man in a fight over a knife, and then Corey Allison is kind of getting stalked by her ex-boyfriend who's a cop, so Corey kind of leads the cop to have Mike to where Michael's staying, and Michael kills the cop with Corey's help. And then Corey kind of goes on to be like do a little bit of vigilante justice on Allison's behalf, it seems. So Allison got passed up by a promotion by a doctor who's sleeping with the nurse. And so Corey and Michael kill the doctor and the nurse kind of together, tag team that. Lori at this time starting to get a little suspicious of Corey. So and so she And also, Corey's parents are starting to get suspicious, so his mom kicks him out of the house, and so Corey sleeps in the abandoned house of the demon child that he accidentally killed. And so Laurie wakes him up. And I really love the scene where they're in the house together. Laurie is on a chair and they're just having this conversation about the nature of evil. Mm-hmm. And then he's kind of starts talking to her and blaming her for some of the issues. And when he looks up, she's gone. And I really kind of, I like how both, I like the cat and mouse of Corey and Laurie in this, as opposed to Michael and Laurie as it's been in the past ones. And then we get to Corey's rampage, where he just goes out, kills the bullies, kills his parents, kills or the DJ, then tries to kill Laurie. Laurie practically kills him, but doesn't quite fully, I guess. Michael finishes the job and gets his mask back from Corey, who had stole it from earlier. And then Laurie and Michael have their showdown. Laurie gets the upper hand, stabs him to the kitchen countertop, bar counter. And just as he's about to die because she slits his throat, he's killing her. She asks him to kill, to just do it. And thankfully, Allison comes in and rescues Laurie, slits Michael's wrists to help him bleed out even more. Then they kind of do this procession through the town with police accompaniment of Michael's body, so the whole town can see Michael's body getting taken to the shredder, where he is shredded and supposedly dead for good, because he was not dead enough, as Allison said earlier, which I liked.
Yeah, really a lot happened in that movie. I mean, I remember that was one of the things when I was watching, it's like, it just doesn't, it just keeps going and going and going. There's no wasted time, no wasted space in that story. And one thing I was almost going to interrupt, but I was enjoying listening to you recap the whole thing, because it reminded me of some stuff that happened. But one of the things that did kind of pull me out of the film was when Corey puts on Michael's, or takes Michael's mask off Michael, right? And we see Michael's old warty, scabby head, you know, as the old Michael is lying on the floor and he puts the mask on. And the only thing I could think of was, that must smell so bad. That mask was, it's just full of 4 years of old Michael Myers stink. You know, I mean, I've right? put on latex rubber masks before for Halloween or whatever, and they smell bad enough by the end of the night just with your own bad breath. That one doesn't have Michael Myers goo in it, you know.
Right, and it's been burned at this point with his face in it, so like it probably has that burnt flesh and hair smell in there too, and all sorts of grossness. I couldn't imagine.
But you know, yeah, it is what it is. But yeah, well, what a good movie! I enjoyed it,
and I like that we get a happy ending for Laurie and for Allison. Allison leaves Springfield, and Laurie, the deputy get together and go, presumably go off to Japan to see the cherry blossoms.
So. Right. Even if they don't, it's something they could do someday. So it was nice for Laurie to finally get a happily ever after. I liked her ending in this one much better than the other times that she had an ending in the other movies.
Right. Yeah. Because let's think about this briefly. Like in Halloween 2, she gets it. The last time we see her, she's being driven away in an ambulance to right. a different hospital. And then we don't see her again. We just hear that she died off screen sometime. Halloween Resurrection, she gets killed right in the beginning, right after her big triumph in Halloween 2-0. Right. So that was a very short-lived triumph there. So, and then the remakes, she gets shot by the police in the Rob Zombie remakes at the end of Halloween 2.
Or ends up in a, remember that one.
Or she ends up in a mental institution. Depends on whether it's the uncut version or the regular version. But in one version, she gets shot and killed by the police. And in the other version, she ends up in a mental institution. Right. So this is really...
Nothing good happens, basically.
This is really the only happy ending for poor Laurie. And I'm glad she finally gets one.
Absolutely.
Deeply diving, diving deeply, deeply diving, diving deeply. You're welcome.
Okay, so I guess we can go into kind of our deep dive here. I have a few things, and I'm also curious what you picked up on. Kind of, it seems like the point of this one, of the whole trilogy, really, is that evil is something that can spread. And this is kind of a quote that, let me see if I can pull it up real quick, that Laurie says in as she's writing her memoir, that she says the events of Haddonfield that created so much violence and bloodshed finally had resolved. New beginnings lay ahead. Fear moves through all of us, and we decide when to surrender. I said goodbye to my boogeyman, but the truth is evil doesn't die, it changes shape. Which I love, of course, because Michael Myers is known as the Shape.
The Shape, yeah.
And also because of the way that this, the first one, the evil side kind of seemed to transfer to the psychologist who led Michael to Laurie's house. And then in Halloween Kills, it kind of went into the mob violence of the town. And then this one, it kind of transfers into Corey, as well as like continuing ramifications of the town as they all seem unhinged. Right. So,
yeah, that was one of the things I thought was really interesting when I saw Ends. It really sort of it made me realize what this trilogy is about. And I think you can think of this movie or this series as it's almost like kind of a Lord of the Rings sort of thing. You know, the Halloween trilogy that we've just seen is the trilogy, and the original Carpenter film is sort of the prologue, the prelude to what we're seeing here. You know, you kind of had to see Halloween, the original 78 one, obviously, because it's a classic, to set this whole thing up. But this is a series of movies about trauma, about dealing with trauma in a very physical and emotional sense. And the first film was about Laurie's trauma and what she's been dealing with for all these years, living in that weird house by herself with the traps and everything, right? And the second film, you sort of got to see how that cascaded into her family and her relationships. And they began to touch on what we see in this third one, which is how the trauma has infected the entire town. You know, and I think they come right out and say it at one point in the film that, you know, you got rid of Michael Myers, but you can't, Haddonfield had to have a boogeyman. You know, and so as soon as they thought Michael was gone, they transferred all that over to Corey. So that was kind of, oh, go ahead.
No, please go finish your thought.
No, I said that was sort of what I was saying earlier on in the show, which was that felt to me that the whole opening pumpkins, the Russian nesting doll pumpkins at the opening of the film, that's what this was all about. It's like, how deep can this trauma go? And at the same time, you've got that you mentioned earlier, just a moment ago, I forgot exactly what you said, but listeners can rewind and his comment on evil. And then again, a few minutes before that, about when they looked at each other in the eyes and had that weird transference. You know, there's this idea in these films, which has actually really been interesting. Like, you're never quite sure if there's something supernatural happening, but it feels like there is. And is the evil just banal human evil, or is it this malign something? You know, that did Michael transfer his evil to Corey, or when they had that connection, did Michael see something akin to himself? Did he see something like, okay, it's time to give this over to Corey, let Corey take over the whole thing? Interesting movie.
Yeah, and it made me think of René Girard, who is a French literary philosopher, and who kind of ended up delving into theology a little bit in his theory of the scapegoat, which he talks about how, I feel like this film is a perfect example of this. So in Girard's scapegoat theory, basically what happens is a community always is going to have always going to have conflict, and that conflict is always going to kind of lead to violence. And so the only way for a community to stay ordered in like an ordered society is to basically scapegoat, to create a scapegoat that the community can drive out or pin the violence onto. So that way it kind of, the community is focused on the violence in that one person or that scapegoat. And then their community is able to kind of have a period of peace after the death or driving out or banishment of that scapegoat. And so we kind of see that happening here, first with Myers and Laurie, and now Corey's kind of the town. So like all these different outlets for the town's trauma and suffering, and how they're all kind of being pinned to a person. And then of course, once Myers is finally put in the wood shedder. It's going, and that scapegoat is finally laid to rest. Corey's dead now as well. Like, there's going to be a period of peace, but as kind of Laurie's memoir seems to suggest, and as Rene Girard would say, that it's only a temporary period of peace before the conflict begins to happen again, and they'll need to find a new scapegoat.
Right. And that was interesting how, you know, exactly what you're saying there was how, like, halfway into the film, Laurie became the scapegoat. Yeah. You know, everyone's like, you poked the bear, you did this. You know, the fact that this, you know, personification of evil is roaming the streets of Haddonfield, you know, doesn't seem to, well, it does bother people clearly. But what they were mad at Laurie about was that, you know, something, you did something to make him angry. It's like, no, he's this demon thing wandering, you know, wandering around killing people. But they needed somebody they could poke at right there and say, this was all your fault. You know, they needed to have somebody to take the fall, to take the blame for everything. Yeah. Which I thought, I was actually just talking to a friend about this yesterday. I thought it was really interesting how much kind of a, like a mirror universe I felt like I was in at that point. And I realized that it's been interesting, you know, for how long we've been watching these films and watching Laurie and watching what she does and how she reacts to this whole world. And the way that the writers and the filmmakers brought in this outsider perspective of what would people think of Laurie if they hadn't been watching her, if they didn't know the specifics of her story, they'd heard it secondhand through the rumor mill. You know, they would think that it was all her fault. She poked the bear. She let the thing loose.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I wonder, One of the things that I feel kind of was a little bit of a letdown of this film for the last three is there were kind of a several narrative threads that they felt like they were kind of tracking, but then kind of didn't fully tie up in this one, which is life. Like, life doesn't fully tie up everything neat in a neat little bow too, so that's fine. But like, still, like, the whole, I was really fascinated by Michael's, in Kills, how Michael began and ended the movie staring out the window. Like, there's something about staring over Haddonfield. And then that kind of got lost a little bit, but it's still also kind of tying into this nature of the town, just having this, of this kind of evil going, spreading throughout the town, kind of like a bite, right, or something. So,
yeah, I remember because I actually just watched, so in preparation for Ends, I did watch the original Halloween. I actually skipped the 2018 version because I ran out of time. I watched Halloween Kills the night before I went to see Halloween Ends. And I know Kills is not one of the ones that everyone enjoyed that much from this trilogy. I liked it. I thought it was a perfectly, to me, again, it was sort of remembering this is the middle film in a trilogy. I think by the time I originally saw Kills, I already knew that they were going to do another one. Yeah. And so you kind of put that the storytelling perspective. Okay, I'm going to go in and see the middle bit. This is the, you know, maybe not the quality of The Empire Strikes Back, but this is the Empire Strikes Back version. It's the bridge between, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. And there, yeah, that was something interesting. I was thinking about that during Halloween Ends. I saw it the day after. I kept waiting for them to come back with what was it he was looking at Haddonfield when he was looking out the window. And they talked about it in Kills that he was looking at a reflection of himself, right? Which is, it's an interesting line, but he could have been standing in front of a mirror or any dark window in the house and seeing himself. And I don't know. I mean, it wasn't addressed in Ends, but maybe he was just looking at Haddonfield. Maybe somehow in a kind of metaphorical level in this setting, he was just the evil of Haddonfield personified. And that's what he was looking at. He was just looking at Haddonfield sprawled out before him in the spot where he did the first kill of you know, the original film, when he first became the Michael Myers, not just little Mikey, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. True. Let's see what else I have here. Oh, there's a tarot card pulled here. Apparently Lindsay, all these years later, is now a bartender and also does tarot. And so the card that Allison pulls from Lindsay's deck is death. And I always just need to point out that what Lindsay said is exactly right. Death in tarot means a change, usually a change through some sort of loss of an old state of being into a new paradigm. But they always use it in movies to kind of signify actual death. whereas if they want to signify actual death, they would have to use the tower card, but that's not quite as Hollywood and death, so I can see why they use death there. And then the last thing I wanted to say was just, I'm not sure if it's intentional, but it might have been of kind of like, as Michael Myers is being pinned to the table with knives into each of his hands, that it's kind of this cruciform image of him. So wondering what that is about, and if there's, you have any thoughts there about what that
might be. And I noticed that. And of course, I was probably thinking a little bit more, you know, in religious metaphors, because I went to see the movie right before when you had asked me, hey, can you be on the Halloween show? I'm like, oh, absolutely. Great.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was kind of thinking, oh, if I watch Halloween Ends, I've got to think about it in terms of church stuff. And I was thinking, absolutely, this is a crucifixion scene. And there was something, I wish I could remember. I would have taken notes, but that would have been rude in a movie theater and have a, you know, a light pen or whatever. But like one of his arms or something was twisted around backwards. Like he was stuck in one hand face up and one hand face down. And I wonder, you know, how intentional that was. Cause it looked obviously like a crucifixion thing to me, but by turning one arm around, are they making some sort of an Antichrist metaphor, or I don't know, you know, they've spoken so much, and, you know, again, back it up a minute here. They've spoken so much about how he has the devil's eyes, you know? There's so much to pick apart in this movie.
Right.
I really liked it. And this is, I really wanted to watch it again. Like the moment it came out of the theater, I'm like, I really want to see this one again. There's a lot to think about.
Yeah. I think out of the three of David Gordon Green's trilogy, this one is definitely the most theological, philosophical. And the second one, I feel like they tried with Halloween Kills, but it didn't quite land with the mob violence for a lot of people. But this one, I feel like it just, there's something kind of palpable in the depiction of Corey and Michael.
I wish I had made some more notes of the timing, because a lot of these, you know, Halloween Kills, something I noticed when I rewatched it this week was the whole mob scene, you know, when they're in the hospital and they're chasing after the guy who's not Michael Myers, but everyone thinks is Michael Myers. And I really wondered if that had anything to do with sort of the, excuse me, I'm not going to say the mob mentality, but how dumped on the movies were by a certain segment of internet fandom, let's just say.
Yeah.
You know, the there was a bit of a mob mentality there. I mean, God, I heard something just the other day that people are like, there's a petition going around to have Halloween Ends remade, which, you know, whatever. But the actors and crew are getting death threats now because people didn't like the way the film turned out. And it just feels like, you know, the filmmakers had something to say about that right there in the middle of Halloween Kills.
Yeah.
You know?
And also with Halloween Kills, one of the parallels I saw living in D.C., was the January 2021 riots in DC, and then seeing Halloween Kills later that year felt very real. So a lot of people were like, oh, people don't act like that. I was like, hey, I lived in DC and this literally just happened a few months ago.
Like, come on Thursday.
Right? People do this. So
yeah. No, I mean, and there's a whole reason why there's a word mob mentality, or it's actually, it's funny watching Kills again this week. That scene was a lot harder to watch this time than it was the first time I watched it, which was only about a year ago. I don't know why. It affected me on a different level now. Mm. I felt so bad for that guy. So, you know, because when he came in, and it's funny because it was long enough ago that I had seen Kills that I'd forgotten that was where that twist was going to happen. But when he's walking into the hospital, and I guess now we're talking about Halloween Kills, so everyone can bear with me for a minute. When he walks into the hospital, there's this point of view shot of people looking at him and getting kind of startled as the Steadicam is meandering through the hospital. And then at some point you see his face in a mirror with a cut on his head, and he's just asking, help me, please somebody help me. In I just drew a blank. You know, in his own way, you know, the guy's clearly got some emotional problems, and then you start feeling sorry for the guy. The whole scene sucks. it sucks in a very well-made filmic way, you know?
For real, for real. Oof. And, this trilogy just, it gets pretty brutal, but, like, it never, the Rob Zombie remakes are brutal, like, in a different way, in, like, an almost hopeless way. This one never quite loses the, I don't know, like, warmth and
humanity.
The character and the humanity, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, the humanity of, like, the characters of Laurie and Karen, who, of course, isn't in this one because she died in the last one, but, and Allison, well, and their relationships.
It's interesting, you know, we've got a series of movies here which basically start with this guy, this character, this thing, you know, whatever Michael Myers happens to be, escaping from a mental institution, right? And that happens, and everyone knows what happens in that movie.
Yep.
And then we move into the Gordon Green trilogy, and the whole trilogy, there's so much thinking about mental illness and what that really means. And it's almost like saying, you know, the original movie just said, he's crazy and he kills people and that's bad. And now it's like you're looking at, again, you know, going back to Laurie's trauma and her daughter and her granddaughter and all of that. And everyone seems to have something they're working through or struggling with. And it's almost like taking a step back and saying, hey, let's look at mental illness as a real issue. You know, what would this feel like in the real world if people were suffering from anxiety or depression or PTSD or such a huge, vast spectrum of things people could have, you know, serious issues with, and not using mental illness as just quite literally a boogeyman.
Yeah, yeah. And I do like that they even talk about how Laurie is going through therapy and stuff like that. Like Allison makes a comment about that and stuff. So, like, it's kind of treating mental illness seriously and not just as the horror trope of the insane asylum escapee coming to.
Right.
Whatever, yeah. Do you have anything else for the deep dive?
How deep did we dive there? I don't know. let's see. There's a lot to think about in this movie. I think anybody who is listening to this and hasn't seen it yet, you should absolutely check it out. It's honestly one of my favorite of the Halloween films at this point. I don't know if I'd put it right up there with the original, but it's got some stuff to say in a very different way. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, yeah. I guess that brings us to rating the movie. And right now we're going through Nightmare of Elm Street, so we've been rating how many nightmares a film is. But because this is Halloween, we're going to go back, throw back to season one and rate it out of jack-o'-lanterns. So out of 10 jack-o'-lanterns, what would you rate this? And do you have a favorite kill?
I would probably put it at about a 7 or an 8 out of 10, if that's our scale. Mm-hmm. And as far as favorite kills, I mean, it's funny when I think about it. There were a bunch of kills in this movie, but not nearly as many as there were in the last one. And right. Halloween Kills, I mean, well, geez, Halloween Kills, he killed almost an entire city block in the last scene of the movie.
Right? Yeah.
But I thought the DJ kill was pretty awesome, only because for me, after there was a lot of philosophizing and talking, and I was making a joke about, you know, my dinner with Michael Myers at some point. There was this certain point in the movie where it was like, okay, there's been a lot of talking. Can we get back to the Halloween part? and the DJ kill to me felt like pure 80s slasher. It was, let's just kill the guy and cut the tongue off. There's a whole, you know, that was an 80s thing, you know. The guy makes a living as a DJ. He talks a lot, so we'll cut off his tongue. Yeah. Live by the sword, die by the sword, or whatever. I go with the DJ kill. What's yours?
Ooh, okay. I think I will rate this probably also around 7 or 8 jack-o'-lanterns out of 10. It was pretty solid. And my favorite kill, I was going to say the DJ, but since you already said that one, I'm going to go with my second choice, which was right at the beginning, the little demon child. Just like the surprise of him, of how that death happened, of like the closet door hitting him and him falling over the thing. And like, and then just the gore of it as the parents are walking in. Like, just incredible setup, a grotesque way to start the movie, and just kind of gives you a clue of what we're in for. So
it was a marvelously, in my opinion, it was a marvelously written and edited scene. You know, yeah. They kept cutting between the guy in, upstairs in the closet banging on the door to the parents slowly driving up the stairway, up the driveway, and then back to the, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And when that kid hits the ground, I was actually like, holy shit.
Right?
They did it. They actually did it.
Yep. I think it's the first one that they like actually like killed a kid on screen in that way too. Like, I think in Halloween Kills we see a few of the trick-or-treaters were killed, but they were killed off screen and they're just kind of set up in the playground. Yes. But this one, like,
yeah,
staged. They'd get killed right on screen.
And did you catch that part? It was like a minute earlier when I love the thing the kid says, you know, the boogeyman doesn't kill kids, he kills babysitters. Well,
yeah.
Did you notice what they were watching on the TV when the Corey was saying this movie's too scary for kids?
No, I meant to. I watched it earlier today to prepare for this, and I was trying to pay attention, but I must have missed that one. What was it?
They were watching Carpenter's The Thing. Which is a callback to the 78 when they were watching the original Howard Hawks The Thing, Laurie and the two kids, where they were watching the original Thing on TV that night. Oh
my God, I didn't even make that connection. That's so cool. So
I thought that was pretty clever.
Yeah, one
Easter
thing.
Eggs.
Yeah,
there's a theology.
right. One thing I will say about the Gordon Green trilogy is just there's so many like small but smart like references and Easter eggs to the original films, just the first one, but to the entire franchise that I just love, that blink and miss it, but it's just really well thought out and stuff.
Very much so. And I've noticed the whole way through, it's like the first two, Halloween and Halloween Kills, were almost reimaginings of the original. I mean, Halloween 2018 is really structurally almost the same film as Halloween 1978. You know, it's Michael breaks out of the insane asylum and rampages through Haddonfield, and teenagers get murdered and whatnot, and Kills, that's the same night, and they go to the hospital, and it's the same thing. And so to me, again, the internet fandom that's angry about this trilogy, whatever, it really, when I watch these movies, I'm like, you know, David Gordon Green and the other people involved clearly have some love for the original films. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe even only the first two, I don't know. But there's Easter eggs, there's moments, there's things where they're really looking at it. It's like, wow, you know, we have this moment to reference this or have a callback to that.
Yeah.
Which I've really enjoyed. I've really enjoyed these movies.
And I would say, I think I even said this to you right after I watched it, because I don't want to give you any spoilers, but like I saw it a few days before you, and I remember texting you that this one felt very Halloween 4 and 5 to me, in the sense that in those two movies, the question of Michael potentially passing his evil on to Jamie Lloyd at the end of Halloween 4. And so I was kind of feeling that vibe with this one, with it kind of being passed on to Corey in a sense. So I feel like they are kind of doing remixes of kind of best hits of the franchise and updating it for.
Very much so. And something I was going to ask you on, Pace and I text all the time. We're good friends. and something I was going to ask you, but I'll ask you now here, and I'll put you on the spot, and you can think about it. Since you just did your whole vampire season, and you did the whole Twilight thing, Corey, to me, felt like it was the Corey and Allison relationship felt like that sort of Edward and Bella bad boy kind of thing. And it was sort of like imagine if like Edward in the Twilight movies had actually been like a real like Nosferatu Salem's Lot vampire. That's what the Corey and Allison dynamic felt like to me. It's like, ooh, she's been attracted to the bad boy. The bad boy who actually like, you know, goes out and murders people with a with a corkscrew in the face, right? So I don't know what you thought about that, but I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you that question. What do you think about that?
No, I like that. I think there's something there. Like, had so much of Edward was like this, like self-pitying, I'm so bad, but like What? Why is he bad? He's stalking a teenage girl, which is clearly bad when he's like 100-something years old.
Super creepy.
Right? Super creepy. But like, he's not like going out and killing people. He's killing animals. So I really like. So I feel like this, like you said, I feel like this would be a much better version of that. Like, he's actually going out killing people. He actually is a really harmful person, and he's also doing that gross controlling thing of, if I can't have Allison, no one can, and that kind of thing.
Right.
To the point of him even attempting to kill himself when he knows Allison will witness it. So that way he's kind of setting up her to see as if Jamie, as if Lori had killed him and stuff. So like that kind of like intelligence of like, I want to harm people, even if I'm not going to make out alive kind of thing.
Right. No, I thought Corey was a really interesting character, especially for one who, you know, hadn't been set up in either of the previous movies. And I guess in some ways he does sort of fill that Jamie Lloyd character, you know, the protege, the idea, I think we mentioned this earlier on, like, is he taking on the evil of Michael as Michael is dissipating, or is it just like Haddonfield needs a boogeyman and this is going to be the next one? The whole thing when they first meet and Mike and Corey gets Michael to kill the cop character.
Yeah,
I thought was really interesting because we almost see again this sort of vampire-like thing happening with Michael, where Michael, you know, comes shuffling out of the hole in the wall and he's staggering, can barely keep himself up. But as soon as he like sticks the knife into the cop, he almost swells up with energy, like he's becoming more Michael. And after he kills the cop, and we know he's been killing random people, you know, that's mentioned from the unhoused character that Corey kills later, that, you know, that Michael keeps dragging people into his den, his lair. And so what was I going to, was that, yeah, it's just, it makes you wonder like how much of, there's something supernatural happening there, but it's not called out, which I thought was very interesting.
Yeah.
You know, not like Jason Voorhees getting hit by lightning and coming back to life or something.
It just, right. I do like
very subtle.
Yeah. I do like they keep the mystery of it alive. And so like you said, it's clearly something supernatural is happening, yet at the same time the character Michael Myers is relatively human in this one compared to some of the other entries in the franchise. And I like that they actually show him as old and shuffling around and stuff, and granted by the end he's almost back to his old self, but like he's never quite as vicious as he was in Kills after, or even in Halloween 2018 after he gets like half burned and stuff. So
right. And there was something like that in Kills. I remember, you know, he had been, the mob had got him and they were surrounding him and he's again staggering, shuffling, not doing well. And I remember the first time I saw it, I was assuming this is it, this is the end of Michael or something. You know, and, you know, who knows what's gonna happen next. But then he kills the first guy. Starts getting invigorated, you know, and by the time he's killed three or four of the mob, he's just gone berserk. He's become this elemental force. So no, it's interesting stuff going on in these movies.
Yeah. Well, since the franchise is so long, I'm not sure we need to rate every single one, but since this is the last of the Halloween franchise for now, and at very least the last of the David Gordon Green trilogy, just sort of wondering, like, maybe if you could at very least rate your top five and see where the David Gordon Green trilogy falls in there with those.
I made some notes on this earlier. Halloween 78 obviously is the top. You know, I will always give more credit to coming up with the idea first. As far as the other ones go, I'm actually going almost, well, not reverse order, but I love this one. I think this was my second favorite of the entire series. Halloween 2018, I would put as number three. Halloween Kills, I put it at number four. And then Halloween 3, which anybody who hates Halloween 3 can go, you know, die in a fire as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
I would put as number five. And honestly, all the other ones, I mean, from from Halloween 4. What was Halloween 4 called? It was the Return of Michael Myers and then the Revenge and the Curse and the, you know, crazy underpants of Michael Myers or whatever. there was no focus. And so I don't even really ever go back and watch any of those because they kind of meander around. They tried to get out of the hole they dug themselves into with Halloween 3, which, you know, we all know the story behind that by now. And so, no, for me, I mean, I will watch Halloween 3 as a standalone at any moment of the day. And this new trilogy with the original as the prologue, I think is pretty much the, for me anyway, the pinnacle of the entire franchise.
Yeah, I really enjoy the trilogy as well as something that is rewatchable. And Halloween Kills especially for me. Well, I guess I should quick rate mine. So Halloween 78 is still number one for me. I love Halloween 2. Holds a special place in my heart. So from 1981, so that's number two for me. But then this trilogy is right up there. Halloween 2018 is number three. Halloween 3, Season of Witch, is number four for me, have to say. But then Halloween Kills and Halloween Ends, 5 and 6. I love Halloween Kills is just such a fun, like, if you don't think too seriously about the plot and just enjoy it for like this nostalgic reimagining of an 80s slashers film in this present day, Halloween Kills is just so gory. So many kills, so much blood and gore. I love that one. And then this one, like I said, it's a great end to the trilogy. As much as you can kind of end the trilogy, I do feel like it's kind of a little bit meandering to this end, and they didn't quite have a clear idea of where they're going when they started, so it's not quite as like crisp of the writing and succinct as like Halloween 78, but still pretty solid trilogy. I'm impressed with it.
Absolutely. And you know, in I guess in John Carpenter's defense, I mean, when he made Halloween 78, he had like $10 to make it, you
know? right
Yeah, you know, he didn't have the giant studio backing these guys have had, and they've been allowed to sort of spread their wings a little bit.
Yeah, and sometimes creating on a this I am by far not the first person to say, so sometimes limitations can help creativity flourish in ways that when you have so much of a huge budget, it can kind of harm the creative process in a little bit of a way.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's pretty much it for our Halloween Halloween Ends coverage. God, they need to start being a little bit more creative with these names. They're all way too similar, especially the fact that we have three Halloweens in this trilogy. All right, three Halloweens in this franchise, two Halloween twos in this franchise, like, come on. And then Kills and Ends. Okay. But
did you see the new Scream 5?
No.
You must have.
Scream, though, just came out. Yeah.
It's just funny because they go in. I mean, I was like, why are they calling it Scream? You know, why not like SC5REAM or who knows, whatever. And it was funny how they kind of called that out in the film. You know, it was so, I mean, the Scream films are basically like, you know, if Meta was a movie, you know, what would it be like?
Right.
And they call that out like, hey, you got to call it by the original thing or whatever.
Yep. Well, where can our listeners find you if they want to follow you or anything?
So my website is benmonroe.com. And you can find out about the various books and stories and stuff I've got coming up. My new book, The Seething, I think Paige mentioned earlier, is coming out in early 2023, I think March 23rd, 2023, I just heard was the release date on that. And my latest short story, The Patchwork Man, just came out in a collection of Western horror stories this summer. You find details about all that on my website, benmonroe.com. And I'm also on Twitter for now. We'll see how that goes. At _benmonroe_. And I just got an account at Slasher, which is the all horror social network. And I use the same handle there, _BenMonroe_ for that one. We'll see if I stick with Slasher for the future.
I am a horror nerd and horror podcast host, and I do not know about Slasher, so please say more. I'm very curious.
Oh.
I feel like I need to. I'm being left out of the cool kids club.
Oh, yeah, it's Slasher. I guess it's new in the last couple of years. It's an all-horror social network, social network. It really is focused just on people who are horror fans who want to have a social network just for horror fandom. I don't know what the... go to the App Store, whatever your favorite App Store is, and download the Slasher app. I think it has a website or something. I signed up for it a couple of years ago, and I didn't really get into it, but some friends of mine have been telling me it's gotten better since then. The first time I signed up for it, unfortunately, all I ever got was marketing materials. I'd friend somebody, and I would instantly get links to their books and stuff. And the feed wasn't very good, but it seems that they've kind of controlled that a little better.
That's good.
Slasher, the social network.
That's fun. So I'm going to definitely have to look into that. And listeners, if I end up making one, I will talk about that in a future episode. But one thing I definitely want to shout out is a recent article that just came out that you wrote, The Noble Art of Scaring People for Their Own Good on Horror.
Oh, yeah.
I'll make sure that's linked in our show notes. But I just love that. And it's kind of goes along with what we talk about on this podcast all the time about the importance of horror and how horror is kind of a community building genre, as well as it is a way to kind of work through our fears and our anxieties and stuff in a safe way. So,
yeah, absolutely. Horror is good for you. Read more horror.
Read
more. Watch more horror.
Yep. Well, our next movie that we're covering is A Nightmare on Elm Street 5, The Dream Child. Came out in 1989 with special returning guest Susanna Porter. So she's going to join the three-time guest club too. So I feel like it's like SNL. We're going to need to have like a special fan club just for the three-time guests and above. So
we don't have to fight or anything, do we? It's not even like a Highlander situation, right? I don't want to do that. I don't want to fight anybody.
No fighting. It won't. No Freddy versus Jason over here. But once again, thank you so much for being on this episode. It's always a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
It's always good talking to you, Pace.
Yep. And that's it for our show. Our theme music was by Matt Warfield. Horror Nerds at Church releases every Thursday. Please comment, rate, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Support us on Patreon and get access to exclusive movie commentary episodes, BooTube episodes, and more bonus content. This month we are releasing our episode on the god-awful Freddy's Nightmares show that went in the very late 80s, which you can watch right now on Tubi if you want to watch that and submit yourself to that awful, cheesy show. But you can do that by going to patreon.com/horrornerdsatchurch. It's only $5 to sign up, so much cheaper. Well, probably about the same price as a corkscrew that you can use to stab people with. Follow us on social media, Facebook and Instagram at Horror Nerds at Church, and Twitter at HNACPOD for all the latest updates about upcoming films, news, and other announcements. Until next time, remember, evil doesn't die, it just changes shape. Bye. Thank you.